Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 95, section 3, which is old single column, page 1045. All right. Let's see. Remember we got started on this paper. It's entitled The Melchizedek Teachings in the Levant. But remember, the point is that we're not just doing the Levant proper. The point was to start in the near-term region where, you know, the Levant was the immediate source for the Melchizedek missionaries, in contrast to what we did in the Far East, where, you know, everything was kind of hopped over to India and then was going out from there. And, of course, Palestine is part of the Levant proper, and so is Egypt. And remember, we got started on what the setting was for the Melchizedek missionaries when they moved into Egypt, or when their influence moved into Egypt, and now they want to focus more specifically on the key aspect of the culture there in Egypt that lent, relatively unique opportunity for the missionaries there relative to other places. Okay, and you can see from the title, you can guess from the title probably, that it probably has something to do with the moral and ethical culture there. So we'll see that when we get started here. Let's see, is there anything, maybe just since, it'll come up. Remember in the very last paragraph, of section 2 there, they talked about how there was, one of the Psalms that was written by an Egyptian. Like I said, we'll see that, mention of that rolling around. Let's see, anything else in there that we need to kind of spin up again? I don't think so. Let's just jump in, and we can pull in the other elements when we need to here. Go ahead.
Section 3, Evolution of Moral Concepts. Although the culture and religion of Egypt were chiefly derived from Andite Mesopotamia and largely transmitted to subsequent civilizations through the Hebrews and Greeks, much, very much, of the social and ethical idealism of the Egyptians arose in the Valley of the Nile as a purely evolutionary development. Notwithstanding the importation of much truth and culture of Andite origin, there evolved in Egypt more of moral culture as a purely human development than appeared by similar natural techniques in any other circumscribed area prior to the bestowal of Michael.
See, right in that final statement, what I was hinting at, more of a moral culture is a purely human development than appeared by similar natural techniques than any other circumscribed area prior to the bestowal of Michael. And as they're giving you in the rest of that paragraph, how does that come to pass? Just because of, the people in the place. You can see they're pointing out, notice how they mentioned much, very much of the social and ethical idealism. So, in other words, a very strong bottom-up focus on the associative elements, the social, the ethical, the directly associative elements, you know, a strong human, you know, sort of unconscious, mostly contextualization, you know, that gives it idealism, as they're saying there, right? So they're very idealistic about those. In other words, they're going to try to exalt, you know, what they deem as proper for social and ethical norms to very, very high, revered levels. Okay? And then on top of that, you've got all of that Mesopotamian leadership stock. Remember, we talked about that, you know, way back, coming in as things wane in Mesopotamia. You know, a lot of those better, you know, Andite descendants moved over to Egypt, and see, like they said there, although the culture and religion of Egypt were chiefly derived from Andite Mesopotamia. Yeah, so the main point there is, you've got you have innately higher genetic nature. So just that basic quality of mind in and of an individual's self can be there. So you have a combination of a reasonable, enlightened individual top-down influence with this very strong collective bottom-up influence, and they're coming together and giving a quite fertile situation for the Melchizedek missionaries to step into. All right. Just one other comment. You know, when they say they're evolved in Egypt more of moral culture, or even in the title, evolution of moral concepts, you know, remember that we're thinking in a very evolutionary sense here, as the title is emphasizing, and as they'll emphasize in the next sentence we read. So, you know, when the revelators say moral, don't jump all the way to a fifth epical revelation, genuine, you know, moral, you know, having to do precisely with conformity with the cosmos and your duty to the cosmos as an individual. Okay. Not all the way to that full objective mode. That individual reference sense that we developed, that we develop, you know, is part of an evolutionary process. And so there's quote unquote moral, right, for a long time. And what does that mean? You know, it's what I've just been stressing. You know, it's just something that you subject yourself to. Just as yourself, not in the context of interaction with others, but just you need to do such and so, or do not such and so. Right? The degree to which a culture has their mores system has been abstracted enough and internalized as this internal reference that is just about your behavior in and of yourself. You know, that part is the kind of the quote-unquote moral part. But once it gets into, well, you know, what about when I'm interacting with Bob, you know, in a barter exchange or something? You know, okay, what's the ethics of that? Okay, you know, then there's that. Then there's that duty to others, that ethical duty. Okay? But you can use the word moral in this evolutionary sense, just like we've been using religion in an evolutionary sense. Right? That... you know, even though it's a long, long time, you know, and still is not here, that what's called religion on the planet is the fullness of genuine, objective religion of spirit. Okay. Now, the other thing to just kind of keep in mind about this is, you see it comes up when we start reading, You know, remember in the levels of meaning that your moral consciousness is on the fifth and your religious consciousness is on the sixth. It's always more immediately natural for a culture to get something that's appropriately called moral before, you know, it's more significantly religious, just because you're moving up and you're at least playing off the shadows from the fifth level before you're playing off the shadows from the sixth. Okay. That doesn't mean there isn't religion, like we talked about in the evolution of religion. It all starts out on the second level of meaning with the sixth adjutant, right? You know, it's a main driver of what's initially called religion. But in a more genuine sense, religious consciousness and playing off its shadows, that will come subsequent to getting something that's getting closer to moral. Okay. All right, so, you know, that's why you could have a lot of moral development, as they're talking about here, even in the absence of some significant religious clarity because of better genetics. All right, let's see what else they say here.
Moral evolution is not wholly dependent on revelation. High moral concepts can be derived from man's own experience. Man can evolve spiritual values and derive cosmic insight from his personal experiential living because a divine spirit indwells him. Such natural evolutions of conscience and character were also augmented by the periodic arrival of teachers of truth. In ancient times, from the second Eden, later on from Melchizedek's headquarters at Salem.
Okay, so like I said, he starts out moral evolution, again reminding you we're thinking in an evolutionary sense. See, and that is not wholly dependent on revelation, which is another way of saying what I was just talking about. I mean, you can, you're not as dependent getting up and playing off at least the shadows from your moral discrimination intuition on the fifth level of meaning. You know, you're not as dependent on revelation, on clarification of truth, to get that. High moral concepts can be derived from man's own experience. Okay, so that part, right up to that part, they're really technically talking about is what I just said. The second cosmic intuition, your moral discrimination in the Holy Spirit encirclement that each individual has. And then they say, man can even, right, evolve spiritual values and drive cosmic insight from his personal experiential living because a divine spirit involves him. So, you know, if you've got individuals of some higher spiritual genetic quality, right, you're going to have a number of people with adjusters. And that just augments it, brings what you have fundamentally through the encirclement of the Holy Spirit helps to bring that to a focus and catalyze it more. Yeah, with the adjuster's presence.
But there wouldn't have been too many of those, right?
Well, I mean, when you're dealing with, remember when you're dealing with reasonable genetic lines coming down from the Andites and the Adamites, you can have spiritual lineages where people are getting their thought adjusters because their parents had a thought adjuster, you know, just like happens, you know, now. You don't have to have people starting out without one, you know, and trying to get up to third circle and getting one, or, you know, necessarily. Right? You can have a number of people that, you know, just have adjusters because their parents did and their grandparents did, et cetera, you know, and it's been passed down. The reason that, independent of the spirit of truth being poured out, anywhere, in a local system or even in the local universe, right, a child can go to the probationary nursery of their local system and get an adjuster at roughly age six because they've got at least one parent. It's on the first Imagine World. And that parent didn't get there without an adjuster, right? They have a soul. That's why they're on the first Imagine World, right? So, I mean, that is always in play, where if the parent, the presence of the adjuster in the parent's mind, while the child is still attached to the parent's mind, right, that parent's adjuster supplies the context for the child's mind, attached to their parent's mind, to get an adjuster also. Okay. So that's just always in play, no matter what. That bridging of the gap between seventh circler and third circler is innate in the parent's mind. Right? So the child benefits from that. It's kind of like, see, the child benefiting from the Spirit of Truth, bridging that gap between seventh and third. Yeah. Okay, so anyway, you've got this, obviously it's more than just genetics. There's some sort of cultural predicate and circumstances of past and present there that got these people to be very, very focused on this as a goal of living, to have this very significant social and ethical ideals that they're striving for. Yeah. And all the spirit ministries will chime in and work with that, you know, as best they can, to try to make it all the more genuine a pursuit. Let's see. And then when it says, such natural evolutions of conscience and character. Okay. We'll see conscience coming up again. Remember, we've talked about that before. Still to this day, people on the planet think that the voice of God within them is what's technically just their conscience. In other words, their exalted mores system that they've put up, in the upper domain, and it speaks as this remote transcendent voice down to the lower domain within them, saying this is the way, right? Think about that. When the book says, that the Spirit of the Truth is saying this is the way, there's almost everyone on the planet goes, oh, I know what that is. It's like, no, you don't. You're thinking they're talking about your conscience, right? Your exalted, objectified mores system that now speaks down to you. Or if you're a Urangibug reader and you discover adjusters, and you go, oh, the adjuster's talking to me. It's like, no, that's the voice of your conscience. Right? And remember, subjectively, you can't tell them apart, because the exact same mechanism that gives you that quote-unquote voice of your conscience, that mechanism is what the adjuster must use. There is no other mechanism. It comes through the same pipe, right, to your ears, as it were. It's a party line. You and the adjuster are sharing, as in the adjuster papers, they tell you, okay, because of that, okay, it's best to not assume that it's your adjuster talking to you. Let's assume this is just a very abstracted, exalted conscience voice, right? And you're talking to yourself, and you probably don't want to deify yourself as the voice of God and run with that. Okay, that whole problematic thing with the conscience, they're going to talk about how Egypt fits into that, becoming such a ubiquitous part of religious thinking. But then also the character. Remember, that is, you have your basic genetically defined temperament. In other words, the genetic framing for the mind attunement in the lower domain, the hourglass analogy. There's your temperament. But the more that you reflect the cosmos in the upper domain, realize the universal harmony in the upper domain, that framing is your character. So when they say character, right, that fits in with talking about why it's valid to talk about this, what they're focusing on is moral. Right, that's an upper domain. They're saying there's some genuineness to getting an upper domain that is not just an exaltation of the lower domain, right? It's some genuine character that's coming in by the grace of God, you know, and giving you a better internal reference. So some of that conscience, right, is the conscience of character, and that, see, there might be some cosmic validity to that as well, right? Doesn't have to, it could be something that's up there because it came down from above, instead of something that's up there that you drug up from the bottom. Right? Either way, it's going to come through as a voice of conscience. And obviously, you know, the more you mature, the more you've got to be able to sort all this out. It's like, well, what's just me and what's subjective? And, you know, that's where the spirit of truth comes in eventually. That's really handy for differentiating, you know, what's actually objective framing and what isn't. All right. So that's the interesting setting. See, for the Melchizedek missionaries, they have a very definitive context to step into in this regard here, more than they did anywhere else. And let's get some more details on just how significant this quote-unquote social and ethical idealism was there. You know, how did they think this through? How did they express it?
Thousands of years before the Salem Gospel penetrated to Egypt, its moral leaders taught justice, fairness, and the avoidance of avarice. 3,000 years before the Hebrew Scriptures were written, the motto of the Egyptians was, quote, "Established is the man whose standard is righteousness, who walks according to its way." They taught gentleness, moderation, and discretion. The message of one of the great teachers of this epoch was, quote, "Do right and deal justly with all." The Egyptian triad of this age was truth, justice, righteousness. Of all the purely human religions of Urantia, none ever surpassed the social ideals and the moral grandeur of this one-time humanism of the Nile Valley.
Yeah, so again, so he's suggesting how relatively unique on the planet the predicate was here for the missionaries. Okay, now so you have all of this, you know, justice, fairness. Right, so they're moving up the levels of meaning there, you know, justice and fairness, first two levels of meaning. And the avoidance of avarice, okay? And besides the revelators never missing an opportunity for alliteration, you know, you might ask, like, well, why did they say avarice instead of greed? Right? They want to make a point that it's, you know, what's the difference between avarice and greed? It's basically, avarice is sort of greedism, right? It's where you're, you know, expanding it beyond the, you know, immediate, you know, specific circumstance or whatever. It's kind of a, more of an umbrella, you know, that you're living under. The thing to note in there as well is thousands of years before the Salem Gospel penetrated Egypt. Okay, because this is so close to Mesopotamia. Right. There's a very, very ancient, much more ancient than current Egyptologists believe, a much more ancient, significant culture there, going back, thousands of years before the second millennium BC. Right. Way, way back. They're thinking and teaching at a relatively high level about quality of self. You know, 3,000 years before the Hebrew scriptures were written. And what does that mean? Right? Maybe they're written during the exile in Babylon, sixth century BC. Right? So, way back, right? 3,500, 3,600 BC. Okay. Yeah, so just that in itself, you're going, if you have any familiarity with sort of Egyptian chronologies, attempted chronologies, to lay all those details along a timeline in Egypt, you're going, that seems to be pushing things to sort of the maximum chronologies at least. It's like, well, it's actually much worse, as you'll see as we read in a little bit. They're giving you hints in here. We won't go off on that sort of scientific tangent, but they're giving you hints about that what we, when we think we date things in Egypt, we need to be a little more humble about that, okay? We're significantly off. And the farther back you go, the more significantly off you are. Until you're talking potentially thousands of years off, right? You'd be burned at the stake by the Egyptologists for even suggesting that. That's just complete heresy, blasphemy. So that's kind of going on underneath here, that whole scientific issue about the chronology. Okay, but when they get into... establishes the man whose standard is righteousness, who walks according to his way. You're going, that's Ptahotep.
Who?
His name is Ptahotep.
There's a lot of Hoteps.
yeah, there's a lot of Hoteps. This is Ptahotep. And you're going, we know when he lived. No. It's like, wait a minute. This looks like he's... Okay, either... He's a lot older than we think he is, a lot farther back than we think he was. Or maybe they're saying that, he's just writing down the oldest thing we have of something that goes back a lot before him. Okay, but either way, some of that oldest stuff that we have, like the wisdom of Ptahotep, is a lot older than we think it is. Whether it's literally tied to him or not.
What do we think it is?
What was that?
What do we think it is?
I think we think he's like 23rd, 24th century BC. Okay. My guess is you can see we're talking about the predicate to, the early second millennium BC, that's like a way far back predicate, not an immediate predicate, your first guess is that at the very least Ptahotep is probably farther back than we think he is. And maybe, these ideas even precede him, right? And, we just don't have any of those, extant written down and, carved on some stone somewhere. If you're familiar with some of this stuff, that truth, justice, righteousness, okay, that's Ma'at. If you know anything about Egyptian thoughts, there's this kind of extended, multifaceted concept called Ma'at. And it even gets personified as a goddess and stuff, but that's secondary. It's more fundamentally a concept, and they're pointing out it has sort of three primary facets to it, which can be described as truth, justice, righteousness. Just that little bit said makes their point. This is sophisticated, right? And this is ancient, very ancient.
You know,
in talking to my Christian friends, the concept of justice is very powerful with them, and I try to put forth the idea that it has to be predicated on law.
Mm-hmm.
That justice is applied law if it's true justice.
All right.
Well, I've never gotten too far with that, but but here we're not talking about law here. We're talking about justice in a triad. And there's obviously some validity to it, or they wouldn't be bringing it up.
Well, and again, you know, notice when they talked about social and ethical idealism, you can imagine they're probably social justice warriors, right? Way back then.
But they wouldn't have been amped up on the sixth adjective.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it's sure it isn't like the 20th century, okay? But
I see a triad gives you some stability. I see there's something.
So there's two things. I mean, yes, they're undoubtedly thinking in terms of, not so the immediacy of justice as applied law, but the socialization of that. In other words, kind of taking it to fairness. But they aren't confused about the difference between justice and fairness. Remember, because they mentioned that, right? Where we just read there. Leaders taught justice, fairness, and the avoidance of avarice. Right? So they're considering the difference. So they would have, even if they haven't gotten to sort of the full abstraction of law, something that's basically law-like, right, that they recognize is, and the immediate application of that is justice in and of itself. And then you expand that to a more interpersonal phenomenon with fairness, right? You lift that up into that associative domain of fairness, and have a socialized justice then. Okay, so they would be reflecting on all those details. But then to your point, to have justice. Put in this triad, notice what the other two are, truth and righteousness. Well, those are the very triune, spherical aspects of the cosmos. And so they're putting that element, that part of justice, in a very objective context, or attempting to. Which also helps it to not go off into all sorts of subjective, relativistic, fuzzy land like so many people today, end up sailing the justice ship off into, right? You're noticing it. They use this word justice, but boy, they've lost all objective focus of exactly what the word refers to, and it's just becoming, a platitude. Makes everyone feel righteous to use, right?
A weapon you pull.
Yeah, not to mention a weapon that you deploy. Yes, all right. So that's the thing that's significant. You can see that you've got this great context where, to the best of their abilities, they're attempting a quite clarified sense of what the proper self is, right? Just in and of itself, and its relationship to some whole holistic sense, some cosmos, right? And they definitely have concepts of of cosmos in contrast to chaos and things too, like the Greeks. Okay, so. I mean, again, see, there's enough reflective life going on amongst the best of these peoples that you have you have them playing with concepts where you don't feel as much need to put quotes around them, Right? It's not sort of as much quote-unquote righteousness or quote-unquote truth. Right? They're getting some of it, you know, to a degree. Okay, so we don't know exactly, you know, how far back we're talking, but we're obviously talking way back prior to Machiavelli to Melchizedek. We've got this in place, and it's coming forward. All right, what else do we have here?
In the soil of these evolving ethical ideas and moral ideals, the surviving doctrines of the Salem religion flourished. The concepts of good and evil found ready response in the hearts of a people who believed that, quote, life is given to the peaceful and death to the guilty. Quote, the peaceful is he who does what is loved, the guilty is he who does what is hated, end quote. For centuries, the inhabitants of the Nile Valley had lived by these emerging ethical and social standards before they ever entertained the later concepts of right and wrong, good and bad.
Okay. So, before we get into this, let's note, because as you start reading this, it's like this is starting to feel not that unfamiliar. I mean, this is starting to sound kind of like some of the best of the Old Testament stuff. I'm getting the feel of, you know, of almost something that Jesus might say or something here in some of this. Okay, and you know, notice in the preceding paragraph when they said, quote unquote, you had them saying, do right and deal justly with all. Did that remind you of something? A famous line in the Old Testament? Yeah, we'll be getting to it, you know, in a couple papers here. Remember when Micah says, no. Good old Micah from the Old Testament, where he says, oh man, what is good? And what does the Lord require of you but to do justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God? See, I can just flip forward a little bit. We're coming up on it because we're going to get into the Hebrews. Obviously, what becomes the thoughts of the Hebrews that are laid down in the Old Testament are coming very significantly from the Egyptians. And you're seeing that. I mean, some of those Old Testament-like thoughts, I mean, are thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years before the Hebrews. Okay? And we're coming down, and they just stepped into that and absorbed that and carried it on. All right? Remember what they said in the first paragraph here. Largely transmitted to subsequent civilizations through the Hebrews and the Greeks. So an awful lot of what we think is the wisdom of the ancient Hebrews is not the wisdom of the ancient Hebrews at all, right? It's the wisdom of the Andite uplifted Egyptians, right? and the Mesopotamians.
It's a very Old Testament.
Yeah, it's a very Old Testament, right? Parts of the Old Testament are older than other parts of the Old Testament. Right? And that's what we're actually studying here, you know, is the oldest parts of the Old Testament, the parts that way predate, you know, anything that you would call Hebrews. Okay, so then, you know, on to this, this paragraph we just read. See, so it starts out, in the soil of these evolving ethical ideas and moral ideals, just for the author to say it so precisely like that, is trying to remind you, okay, don't just put great big quotes around everything here. These people kind of sort of know what they're talking about, right? Even, you know, more so than anyone today, understanding, you know, the difference between an idea and an ideal.
was going to say Egypt's not like this today.
No, of course not. Right, you get rid of the Adite, you know, genetics or at least cultural, you know, influence, and right. So you know, we've often talked about this. What's the difference between ethical and moral? What's the difference between idea and ideal? You know, look at they're putting them together here, so you can play off both of them, right? You know, you have the more transcendent, big picture, or horizon object, right, of moral or ideal, right? And that's brought down into relationship with the specific, into relationship with time, into the relationship with others, right, as ethics or ideas, right? Those are the you know, the others applied, right? You know, your ethics is based upon your morals. The ideas are based on your ideals. All right, so there's that. It's that interesting little bit. And see, and then they're pointing out, again, they're, like they said up front, the really immediate conscious focus is sort of the best, you know, the highest exaltation of the bottom-up collective, you know, social, ethical. They're in need of additional revelatory assistance to get a little bit more definitively, consciously, individually focused on, you know, what you would call more the religious. The concepts of good and evil found ready response. See, they can be introduced to these more unity concepts in contrast to the associativity ones. And it's not that much effort because they've thought so much about the sort of the ceiling of the associative to just kind of give them that more consciously the unity endpoint of that and get them to add that in is not that big a step. But like they say there at the end, they had lived by these emerging ethical and social standards, those associative things, before they ever entertained the later concepts of right and wrong, good and bad. You know, really getting more into that, you know, fully just in and of yourself, religious, you know, individual, and more tied back to eternity instead of about the doings in time stuff.
So the concepts of good and evil are the same thing as the concepts of right and wrong, good and bad, right?
Okay, so, yeah, and what do they mean by that parenthetical there? You know, right and wrong and then M dash, good and bad. You know, you have just conceptually good and ungood, that is bad, right? So you have that contrast. You know, in like fact, truth, goodness, right? Fact, non-fact, truth, falsehood, you know, goodness, badness. You have those contrasting elements, individuality, associativity, unity. But then when you bring in choice, right, then you bring in right and wrong, right? You make a wrong choice when you grab a hold of bad. You make a right choice, and you grab a hold of good.
As long as you can determine what's good.
I mean, yeah, just theoretically, you know, what do these words refer to? Yeah, and it's important to think about that because you can't look these things up in the dictionary and get it properly. Right? The revelators are trying to get us clear on what do these words properly apply to. Right? So you have that. You know, that differential between good and bad, you know, that just is there. But then there's a question of you taking a hold of something, you choosing, right? And, you know, so it's, you know, you make a right choice or a wrong choice. But, you know, the unity nature of the form in your mind is good or bad. Right? So it's, you know, what do you, precisely you're talking about. Right and good are not synonyms. In other words, you have to think about that difference. Okay, but that sort of, like when we talk about the difference between error and evil. If I give badness form in my mind, that's evil. Well, what's the difference between the evil state of my mind and the erroneous state of my mind? I mean, what difference am I pointing out, trying to point out there? That evil aspect, you're just looking at you, the part, as an individuality. You have that unfortunate state of mind. When you error, isn't just considering you in and of yourself. It's considering you in relationship to the whole. It's putting the part in the context of the whole when you talk about truth and error. Right? But goodness and evil, that's just talking about what the part is in and of itself. Yeah. And so that's another thing. It's very important to begin to sort out in your head and get clear on.
Part in and of itself, I keep screaming, but relative to what?
Well, of course, there's always the objective reference, but I'm it's not like, goodness and badness are defined within you, right? I mean, obviously they're defined against an objective reference, okay? But right, it's think of it more as a quality of the part itself. This is a bad part. Okay, as opposed to this part is in an erroneous relationship to the whole. Okay? I mean, in both cases, you're considering it relative to an objective reference, but one is fundamentally an associative quality, right? The truth and error, right, is an associative quality. Whereas the goodness or the evil, it's just a quality of of the unit. It's speaking to the unity nature of the part. Okay. And don't think that you should have this clear. I mean, humans have never been able to get this clear. That's why the revelators, when they're talking about the Lucifer Rebellion, say, okay, you humans have been completely confused for all of human history on these things, and you need to work out exactly what all these words actually refer to and get it straight in your heads, because you're constantly blurring them all together. And it's not easy to get that all clear in your head, because it's complicated. Back to this whole issue, and they're saying that, these later concepts of like good and bad, right and wrong. See, notice how that what they were thinking before. The peaceful is he who does what is loved, okay, not who does what is good.
Right.
And the guilty is he who does what is hated. As opposed to saying it, what is wrong or what is bad. See, so they're starting. They're not starting out kind of talking about it in sort of quote-unquote religious terms, see? They're getting at this from the bottom up, so it's in those, those more social ethical sorts of ways.
And social context.
Yeah, right. Not quite as completely sort of objectified, up to the religious consciousness. That's what they're getting at. And so the Melchizedek missionaries are trying to add that cream on the top, see? Yep.
Well, but it's kind of like what is loved as a group.
Right, right.
Not what is loved by an individual.
Of course. I mean, obviously, then what's their definitions of love and hate? I mean, obviously that comes into play, too. But
like you're saying, I mean, it's a social you know, it, you're pulling the individual up to a level that we agree on as a social group.
Right. Right. And so, yeah, just see, they're taking that associative consideration to its, like they're saying, those idealistic heights that they're trying to envision and trying to live up to, and then they then they consider themselves to be judged, you know, when they die relative to that, those scales, right? That they're weighed, you know, the scales that weigh them are in this sense. Yeah, it's not really a good-bad scale, see, which is more of this, you know, it's kind of a simple religious sort of modality of talking about it. It's this more complicated sense in which they consider themselves to be judged and what they're, you know, what they're trying to challenge themselves to live up to. All right, what else here?
Egypt was intellectual and moral, but not overly spiritual. In 6,000 years, only 4 great prophets arose among the Egyptians. Amenemope, they followed for a season. Akhban, they murdered. Akhenaten, they accepted, but half-heartedly for one short generation. Moses, they rejected. Again, was it political rather than religious circumstances that made it easy for Abraham and later on, for Joseph to exert great influence throughout Egypt in behalf of the Salem teachings of one God? But when the Salem missionaries first entered Egypt, they encountered this highly ethical culture of evolution blended with the modified moral standards of Mesopotamian immigrants. These early Nile Valley teachers were the first to proclaim conscience as the mandate of God, the voice of deity.
Yeah, so let me just, you know, take that last point first, because I told you it was coming. It was these early Nile Valley teachers, right? They were the first to proclaim conscience as the mandate of God, the voice of deity. That's where everyone on the planet got this notion from. It's them pounding that, you know, and disseminating that out into the world. That conscience is the mandate of God, the voice of deity.
From the Melchizedek teachers.
No. Well, I mean, yeah, not necessarily the Melchizedek teachers, you know, but from these, you know, these cultural teachers. See, you know, they encountered this highly ethical culture and evolution, you know, blended with the modified. See, it's those, you know.
That was already there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, sure, the Melchizedek missionaries came into it, but see, they sort of absorbed into that, you know. And, you know, but it's really not coming from the Melchizedek missionaries directly. It's, they're getting modified by this very, very effective influence that they step into in Egypt. You know, it became Machaventa didn't teach the Melchizedek missionaries that. Right? He would never teach them that. Right?
Because it's not correct.
Yes. Right. So, yeah. Yeah. It gets disseminated because it gets, remember how we talked about the snowball rolling across Asia and accumulating all of the various things there. The snowball rolls into Egypt and it picks up this conscience as the voice of deity idea and then spreads it all over the place. Yeah. The reason it took on so definitively and spreads like wildfire, it seems so correct to you in your sort of your natural mode of mind. You go, yes, yes, I agree with that. Right? It's very difficult to convince yourself otherwise. Yeah, and like we've talked about before, the reason it's so difficult to think that that's not valid is that's why we don't have a cylinder analogy, why we have an hourglass analogy, right? So that you have these, you know, basically two domains connected by just a little neck, and really, you know, you think that you're just the lower domain. So when something comes from the upper domain, which is you, you don't think it's you. It sounds like it's coming, you're on the second level of meaning. You can't even see, that there's a place to stand in the neck, right? It goes up to this point and you look up in your mind and this voice comes down seemingly from nowhere, right? Out of a point, an infinity. This booming voice in your mind, tells you how it's supposed to be. You're certain that's coming from outside of you, right? And it's just because when Jesus says, I would lead you up from the second to the third, the first step is he leads you up and you get on the third and you go, oh, seriously? I'm still inside myself. I'm standing here. That voice was never coming from outside of me. It was coming from me. That's one of the first things that you get. Recognition. Okay, now I get it. Recognition, realization, appreciation, love. Remember those little steps up? That first step of it dawning on you, how this really works. And that's not outside at all. You're going, oh, dear me. I've been thinking that was an objective outside voice this whole time. I've been following it without question.
I hope I'm not straying off the topic. Yep. But I'm just thinking about today's political climate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We talked about the political climate then.
Yeah.
We have a political climate now.
Yeah.
And there's a very big schism.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like these people over here have a certain mori system
mm-hmm.
that they are locked in.
Consecrated to, yep.
Consecrated to. And yep. These over here have a mori system that they're consecrated to. It's not clear in anyone's mind what exactly these differences are, but they're one's over here and one's over here, and they don't.
Right.
They don't communicate well.
I don't feel that way with my wife.
And the degree to which, right? It's really like you said. When things start to get tribal, so you have, you have a multiplicity of mori systems, right? You have different voices of deity, right? Quote unquote, right? And that's not going to compromise easily.
That's the measure of righteousness.
You're not going to get me to not follow my voice of deity, right? And it's like, well, I'm following my faith. No, you're not. I mean, mine is the voice of deity. Yours is obviously the voice of the devil or whatever, right?
It's just from inside.
Right. This is why. See, the more that it takes on this fully religious conceptualization, the more impossible it is for us to get along, right? Because we have all of this false exaltation and absolutization, existentialization of self is going on. Yep.
I have a question on the very first sentence.
Yep.
What do they mean by the term spiritual here?
Yeah, okay.
Intellectual, moral, but not overly spiritual. I mean, of course, we go into this whole thing, religious and not spiritual and so on and so forth. And I'm a little confused on what they mean by spiritual.
Yes, okay. I was just about to go back and bring that up. Let's what else do we have in this paragraph? We got a bunch of things in this paragraph. So that's step one. Egypt was intellectual and moral, but not overly spiritual. What do they mean by that? Again, just picture it in the hourglass analogy. Okay, so the intellectual is just a coarse way of saying they have some of the basics of at least the shadows from the third and fourth levels of meaning. They aren't just mental; they're intellectual, and they're at least working with the shadows of the fifth level of meaning, the moral level, the fifth level. Okay, but not really the sixth level, the spiritual level.
Which is what?
Which is, they're not really bringing in directly spiritual insight. They're not bringing in directly any direct recognition of values. They're not bringing in any direct God-knowingness. They're not bringing in any direct religious consciousness, personal spiritual consciousness. Right? You can say a number of things. I mean, they're not bringing in that sealing of the upper domain, that part of your mind at the top that is in direct interplay with literal spirit ministry above the mind.
Specifically, you know, definitely not being a son of God, right?
Right. They're not thinking there's a God and I'm a son of God. All of those thoughts come from your spiritual insight on the sixth level of meaning, that spiritual that they're talking about. They're not overly spiritual. Right, so they don't have, like we were just talking, they don't have a kind of a completed sense of them as a spiritual child, an individual of a spiritual father. They see themselves as an exalted collective.
Is it more humanistic?
Right, so it's humanistic, exactly.
They didn't even use the word humanism.
They did, right? Remember, they moral grandeur of this one-time humanism of the Nile Valley, right? Okay. You're just lifting up from the humus as much as you can, really, and playing off of that fifth level. When you think about, talking again about the levels of meaning, when you're on the fifth level, that's the level of selflessness. So think about, you're starting with, the very crude self, and you're trying to get up, into senses of self-control and whatnot. And you can only take that up to the point where, well, and then there's sort of the ceiling is, not sort of better and better and better self, but just selfless. Okay, but notice you still have to use the word self to describe that state. Right, to go above that is to totally turn the back on the self, because it goes from selflessness on the fifth to godlikeness on the sixth. See, where you now, instead of defining yourself as an ever more transcendent self, you start at the top and work down. You start with God and work down as I'm a child of God, and in that way I'm godlike. And now let's bring that down into the lower domains and out into the world.
Humbly.
Right. That's what they mean by spiritual. They're not like that. See, they're not starting with God and then getting to them.
You see that quite a bit these days. I don't know, maybe I'm missing that. But
right.
I'm spiritual, but I really, oh, I see that you're saying.
Right. See, but again, that's not right, yeah. I mean, humans don't know what they mean when they're saying they're spiritual and not religious.
They're religiously non-spiritual.
I mean, in general, those that are saying that aren't either.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. They illustrated that by saying in 6,000 years, which is a
long yeah.
There were only four prophets. They're talking about spiritual.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which goes right. Back to your thing on the timing, because yeah. Moses, when was he?
Yeah, okay, yeah, don't jump ahead here. Hold on, I'm going to get to that. Let's step through that. There's a whole bunch there. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so I think we've got that what do you mean by spiritual there? Yeah, and then the next thing you see is, in 6,000 years, okay, now, avoiding trying to pin that down exactly what 6,000 year span they're talking about, what's the beginning and end points. Okay, even without that, just saying 6,000 years, it's like, well, wait a minute, that's the very least twice what you would talk about with Egypt.
Yeah.
Right, in our sense of Egypt, ancient Egypt.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, of course, you can go way back before that when it's more literally Andite than Egyptian, okay? But, just saying that is reminding you. Yeah, you have some work to do yet on your Egyptian chronology stuff. It's a lot longer than you think. Okay, and then you get to some more specific hints. You're going, wait a minute. Okay, this is obviously in chronological order. Menemope, followed by Achmon. It's like, well, I've never heard of him. Yeah, well, because they murdered him. Okay, so he didn't get writ large, okay? But he came next. and then Akhenaten, and then Moses. And then you remember what John was remembering. It's like, wait a minute, way back in the Adam and Eve papers, it said, and then the tradition of Adam's 6 days got woven into the story, with the result that almost 1,000 years after Moses' sojourn on earth, the tradition of creation in 6 days was written out and subsequently credited to him. Right. And not, you know, during the 6th century BC is when that was all written out and credited to him. Oh, so in other words, he died about 1500 BC.
Plus 6,000.
Okay. Well, okay, well, you got that. See, that's the possibility, you know, that goes way back to into 7500 BC, or if that's what they mean by the 6,000. But, yeah, setting that aside, you know, just stick to the Moses thing, okay? They've given you, see, and this is something, you know, first of all, a lot of scholars don't believe Moses was an actual person, right? Okay. You know, he's like Lao Tzu, right? They've decided he's just a myth. Right, and there's an obvious reason for them to conclude that, like they're talking about here. You know, it was written down and accredited to him. Right? See, they're picking up on that. You know, okay. You know, so first of all, they're telling you, no, there was a real Moses. Okay. You know, and even those that think that he was real, you know, they're guessing maybe, you know, he lived, you know, like, you know, maybe he died, you know, 1200 or 1300 or something like this. It's like, no. He, you know, they're telling you basically he died at 1500 BC. Okay? And Akhenaten preceded him. And you're going, wait a minute. No, my Wikipedia page or whatever, my Egyptian chronology says that Akhenaten is back in, you know, 1300 or whatever BC. See, he's a lot older than that.
I found an error in the book.
Right, you didn't find an error in the book. Right, they were only allowed to give you these hints because there's issues with what we've deduced. Right, we've got some assumption issues. Right, right. So they're, you know, and then of course it's really glaring. Okay, and so Akhenaten is okay. You know, Akhenaten is after Machaventa. Okay, I mean, he's in the second millennium BC. Okay. But he's older than Moses, and Moses died at about 1500. Okay, and then there was a guy before him, and then somewhere way back, and it could be way, way back, because they threw this 6,000 years thing in, there was a Menomope. It's like, wait a minute, we think of Menomope was about 1,000 or so BC, 1100 or something. Like, no, he's way back. Okay. So, I mean, so
7 or 8,000 BC.
Well, I mean, who knows when he was? I mean, see, they're not giving you the details, but they're at least giving you an order and expanding so that you don't think, well, it's got to happen sometime before, you know, 3,000 or something, because there wasn't anyone in Egypt, you know, doing this sort of stuff, you know, before 3,000 BC or, you know, it's like, no, open that up, you know, and see if you can slowly work your way into stretching it out and filling in the blanks.
But they are saying that it was essentially, they're capping this 6,000 years of these, with these prophets. So,
well, are they?
That's what I'm asking.
See, it's not, you notice it's not that specific. You don't know if from Amenemope to Moses is 6,000 years. You don't know that. Uh-huh. You know, it may be that kind of what you would consider all of Egyptian history is 6,000. You know, so maybe say going back to, you know, 6,000 BC or you know, something instead of 3,000 BC. I mean, that might be what they mean by it. You know, and over that whole span of all the Egyptian civilization, there was only 4. Could have been a long time before Menomope. You don't know, the way they've said it.
An understatement about not being overly spiritual.
Right. A lot of time and only 4, though, see? And notice it says prophets, okay? Mm-hmm. Well, great prophets. It could have been other prophets. There was only 4 great prophets. Great prophets. That means someone that celestials are actually engaging, not someone who's just using, you know, taking delight in cultivating, using their Holy Spirit better than the run of the mill. Okay. And to be engaged, you're going to need to actually have fired up all the way to the ceiling and up to the sixth level meaning. Right? And there's not many, that are fired all the way up where they can be engaged by a celestial from the outside, from the top down. Okay? That you got a question? Or?
Oh, just wondering, what do you think went wrong with Akbon there?
He was probably too bold in his enlightenment.
Right. Way outside the bell curve.
Yeah, Jesus didn't last long either, yeah. Right?
Maybe that's a backhand compliment.
Right. Yeah. He might have been the best of the four, for all we know, but, he didn't last long enough for it to manifest. Like I said, between the lines, there's all this chronology stuff that's kind of interesting. In terms of the science of Egyptology. Gene brought it up. Okay, again, was it political rather than religious circumstances, right, that made it easy for Abraham and later on for Joseph, etc.? That's an important thing to remember, and we talked about that. You're how this works. If your goal is to eventually improve the quality of religion in the main evolutionary stream, you have to get it into the political, moray system in an enduring way, and then the culture will distill its new cult out of that. You're not going to build it. You have to let the evolutionary process distill that improved religion. So you can't just magically improve the religion. Right? You got lots of they're going to talk about that a lot with Thich Nhat Hanh. You got a lot of great religious minds that don't have the material pragmatism skills. They've got the spiritual idealism skills, but not the material pragmatism skills to actually produce a lasting phenomenon.
Isn't that what happened when Rome embraced Christianity? What was the name of the emperor? 300 BC.
Yeah, Constantine.
That really, the whole political thing really made it turn
right.
it off.
It's, there isn't any other way, right? I mean, that, how did, we just read it, how did Buddhism get going?
That's true.
Right? It's always when, you've got someone that really knows how to get it into, the social, political, economic system, the main, the moray system, and
put it on an app.
Get it in there, and then let the evolutionary process distill the better religion.
These were the code writers back then.
Better religions are grown; they're not built. Wild-eyed religionist, appreciates that, right? They all think that they can just wave some magic wand and ta-da, there's going to be this better religion on Earth. Did you have something else here? You're looking at me like you're about to say something there.
Well, there was a comment back in the Orient about somebody did their work too well.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking to your point.
Yeah. Yeah.
That it didn't take hold for that reason.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to get probably the greatest example in all of human history when we get to section 5 of this very issue. Right? Thich Nhat Hanh is the poster child for this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there's important lessons for those that would love to be an evangelistic influence in the world, right? To remember there. Okay, let's see. Anything else here? Let's see. Political sagacity. Let's see. We've basically said all that. Just again, they're reminding you in there that when the Salem missionaries get there, you've got this incredible context. Okay, that because it's so much closer to the roots of the Andites, it's a much more significant Andite predicate than, say, you had in India, right? Which is much more farther removed and diluted and whatnot. So the Melchizedek missionaries had a significant context to step into here. All right.
Section 4, the teachings of Amenemope. In due time, there grew up in Egypt a teacher called by many the, quote, son of man, and by others, Amenemope. This seer exalted conscience to its highest pinnacle of arbitrament between right and wrong, taught punishment for sin, and proclaimed salvation through calling upon the solar deity.
Okay. All right. So, we were, like I said, you see these things that they've, quoted here. Now, of course, they're putting them in English in a way that makes it even more suggestive to you of the way it's said, say, in the King James Version in the Old Testament, right? Right. But again, it's revealing the truth. That, they're telling you in truth, you had things like the Son of Man really in play way back there whenever Amenemope was. Okay?
And it said he used that term too, right?
Those things that Jesus was picking up on, see, are these long, deep threads that he's grabbing a hold of and using. And he's not originating so many of those things. And so here, like they said, this seer exalted conscience to its highest pinnacle of arbitrament between right and wrong. Right? So, the arbitrator of what's right and what's wrong, your conscience tells you so. And again, so you go, oh, it's not just the Egyptians. Really, everyone believing that bit about the voice of deity, you can take that back to one very effective, influential individual, Amenemope. And they'll talk about how it is that he was so incredibly, significant to the history of civilization.
Is Ra the solar deity? When you hear about it?
We'll get to that a little bit. When you post Akhenaten, you have that Amun Ra concept, mm-hmm. where the Ra part is really bringing in the solar deity. But all that is in the wake of Aten, the solar disk concept being put forward by Akhenaten. Everyone had sun god, going way back, like we read, so that's an old thing. And of course, in the desert, it's definitely going to be a biggie. The orb, right, is going to reign supreme. All right, what else do they say here?
Amenemope taught that riches and fortune were the gift of God, and this concept thoroughly colored the later appearing Hebrew philosophy. This noble teacher believed that God consciousness was the determining factor in all conduct, that every moment should be lived in the realization of the presence of and responsibility to God. The teachings of this sage were subsequently translated into Hebrew and became the sacred book of that people long before the Old Testament was reduced to writing. The chief preachment of this good man had to do with instructing his son in uprightness and honesty in governmental positions of trust, and these noble sentiments of long ago would do honor to any modern statesman.
I'll say. Yeah. Wasn't Gene talking about that just a minute ago? Yes. Yes. If only. Right. And see, in this, you hear me say this all the time. A lot of the great things that we talk about in the Urantia book, it's like, okay, you don't need the Urantia book. Everyone should know the book of Proverbs, like the back of their hand, and we would find civilization again. The reason we're losing civilization, why government doesn't work anymore, one of the main reasons is no one there knows the book of Proverbs anymore and predicates their life on it. Right? All you'd need is just the book of Proverbs. All you'd need is a Amenemope, and we'd have this huge step up you know, in our civilization again. Right, it's an exalted humanism. Right, the debased humanism we've got now is not going to, you know, uphold civilization. All right, so see, remember how they said they were, you know, you had a few that were kind of spiritual, like, and like I said, they're going to have God. See, and notice they're not pulling their punches. They didn't say God knowingness; they said God consciousness. You know, just to emphasize that he got the sense of God, and as they were want to do there, he was trying to push that to the highest idealistic reaches he could. You know, and it's worthy to not just call what he had merely God knowingness, but the full exaltation of that.
And this is spiritual.
Yeah. And you know he literally has it super consciously because he has an adjuster, right? So literal, you know, God consciousness. I mean, you can't literally have even super consciously God consciousness without an adjuster. You can have God knowingness without an adjuster, right? But you can't get to God consciousness even super consciously without an adjuster. And see, so he's telling you he's got a very adept adjuster, right? There's literal God consciousness all the way at the top. He's playing with the shadows that casts down in his mind, which has been fostered by literal engagement by celestials in some way, because he's literally a prophet, etc. Okay, that's what they're getting at there. He's working transcendent of exalted humanism. See, in other words. And when it finally gets boiled down and passed on for ages, and whatnot, okay, maybe it kind of is, more humanistic, but still, its predicate within him was not merely an exalted humanism. And they say at the beginning there, where did the Hebrews get that whole notion, of how you can tell if you've found favor with God? Right, and the whole Job story, right, and all that. Right? It's coming from the Egyptians. It's coming from Menomopi.
A long time ago.
Yeah. Let's see. Anything else there? The other element. You're joking about the governmental positions of trust there. See, notice one of the reasons why it was so effective. He didn't just talk about it very abstractly. It was in an actual practical context, right? Of instructing his son in uprightness and honesty in governmental positions of trust. So it was a story that people could, directly relate to. They didn't have to be way off in some reflective abstract space, to try to figure out what he was talking about. It was very tangible. So that also sees a lesson. I mean, effective teachers, which I struggle to be, can put things in a very tangible context, like Jesus did with his parables, right? A story that everyone can relate to.
Yeah.
I struggle to do that. I have a more immediate relationship to it in a kind of an abstract space. And then I'm trying to figure out ways to get you that when I see that you're going, what is he talking about? I'm just trying to think of a way to analogize it, picturize it, whatever, so that you can kind of get it.
Okay? You only read my mind.
interesting. Anyway.
Just got to be more vivid.
All right, what else do we have here?
Well, I wanted to bring up about riches and fortune were the gift of God.
Mm-hmm.
But I can see where he would get that. I mean, it kind of like what they say in the psychic circles context, that a lot of times material success follows through growth.
Mm-hmm.
The more sort of God conscious you are, maybe using that term loosely, you do better in the physical world. So it's not like that's completely
right. Like we've talked about, I mean, Yeah, I mean, like you're saying, when they talk about the cosmic levels, the psychic circles, you know, having higher levels of cosmic consciousness innately means you have a more precise, effective, objective relationship to material affairs, right, in that better context. But the mistake that they made way back then, and people still do today, is, cosmic consciousness implies material effectiveness, but material effectiveness doesn't imply cosmic consciousness, right? You know, and our relationship with God, right? It's that inappropriate reversing of the causality. It gets people into this, into thinking this. You're judging the book by its cover. You see this successful person, and you just judge him by merely his outer life. You don't recognize the reason he's successful in his outer life is because he has a solid inner life. Right? But if the person assessing the situation has no insight, right, they don't even know about inner lives. Right? All they see is what's manifesting and get the causality backwards because of that. All right, yep, keep going.
This wise man of the Nile taught that, quote, riches take themselves wings and fly away, end quote, that all things earthly are evanescent.
No, not effervescent, but evanescent. Evanescent, in other words, they just, drift away like smoke, diffusing, right? It slips through your fingers and just vanishes.
His great prayer was to be, quote, saved from fear. He exhorted all to turn away from, quote, the words of men to, quote, the acts of God. In substance, he taught, man proposes, but God disposes. His teachings, translated into Hebrew, determine the philosophy of the Old Testament book of Proverbs. Translated into Greek, they gave color to all subsequent Hellenic religious philosophy. The later Alexandrian philosopher Philo possessed a copy of the Book of Wisdom.
So it was, as recently as 2,000 years ago, had that, was working with the original Amenemope's Book of Wisdom, not the derivative Book of Proverbs. So again, you've got all of this great insight, and then you have, you had the Son of Man, and now you have saved from fear, right? Fear not. Right? Remember how many Jesus-like things we saw in Lao Tzu, right? You're seeing it here again. Turning away from the words of men to the acts of God. Again, he's getting all the way up to the sixth level in a more conscious way. So he turns things 180 degrees. Right? Instead of just the exaltation of man, right? You make God the predicate, and we're his, his offspring. We're downstepped expressions. I think I got everything there.
Man proposes, God disposes.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I knew there was something else there. Yeah, that's what it was. You have this concept that you put forward in your mind, but you're not sovereign out there, right? Like where you are when you're, putting forward this in your mind. It's in the hands of God how things actually get arranged out there, right, in the external world. That's what I mean by God disposes. Okay. It's in his arranging hands, ultimately.
Yeah. God going to partnership, great.
Wonderful things can and do happen.
Right? The acts of ours, the consequences are God's, right? I mean, all those sorts of things. You know, see, he's recognizing that way, way back.
And that's the reverse of what a common thought today is, that we have to be the hands of God. I mean, God has no, kind of assuming God has no hands.
Right.
He's depending on our hands to do his work.
Right. There's an element there, but it's obviously, like you're suggesting, ripe with potential for pride and self-righteousness and flipping things around. I mean, where's the humility? You can't micromanage the external world. You know, you see to it that you have a better inner life. You let the fruits naturally flow out, and you let the evolutionary process do what it needs to do with it. Right? And you're not making all sorts of inappropriate expectations about, you know, your footprint on the earth.
Right, it's like casting seeds. Right? Some will grow this way, some will do this, and so on and so forth. We still got to cast them.
I mean, you know, you're not, you know, it's not like you don't have any relationship, but, you know, it's just humility. The whole point is not to act in pride, it's to act in humility. But you're acting. It's just getting that inner life humble predicate.
Jesus certainly proposed a lot of things that got disposed of.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's when you're reading in, you know, like Jesus in Galilee, you know, Jesus is proposing all kinds of things in his mind, and, well, okay, so it's not going to go that way. he very much learns God disposes, okay? It's like, I had this great plan, and this thing, and, you know, it just went nowhere, right? Because the big picture is not even in his hands, right? And he discovered that humble relationship of the child, right? That, you know, he can't know as merely a creator son, right? He's added that creature humility in relationship to the whole to his nature, and that's what makes him a master son. See, humility led to his self-mastery. As a master son, it'll lead to your self-mastery too.
It's like when he came down from after his 40 days, you know, when he'd say something like, and his last decision was to come down and start preaching the gospel and let God and says his thought of us to work out the daily procedures day by day. In other words, you're right. That I think that's good for all of us to learn.
Yeah. And it's just, you know, he's got those six great decisions, you know, those are sort of the plan A things, and, you know, and immediately plan A gets kind of blown up, you know, and I mean, by the time he's, you know, approaching death, you know, he's on plan triple Z, you know, I mean, he's you know, he discovered, you know, that the big picture is so big that not even he, you know, can really wrap his mind around it. You just have to humbly do your little part and trust that it'll work out the way it needs to work out.
When he has to touch back to prayer just to get himself stabilized and stuff.
Yeah, it's so important to see his life with clear eyes, you know, and not treat him as some magical, mystical thing that, you know, everything just, you know, fell into his lap. It's like, no, it's just the opposite. He had to face the fact that best laid plans of mice and men just, you know, don't go anywhere.
What happened at this point? Best laid plans.
You know? Okay. I mean, even the most simplest thing, you know, it's like, okay, so this is no grand plan. It's just, I'm going to do just one of those simple things. Nope, it's not even that's going to work. You know? It's just... So he just, you know, he learned that's the life we live. He understands that you're not sovereign out there. And boy, does it become obvious when you try to think you are, right?
But it's got to be cool for the, you know, to watch this planet from the outside, you know, as such a unique, like we're going through with the flow of truth, like now it flows into Egypt, and then and then a couple of threads go to the Hebrews, and one goes to the Greeks. I mean, that's got to be cool to watch, just being so unusual and all over the map.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because they're watching the doings of the whole, right. So much there. You know, I mean, Yeah. On this planet, like few others, you don't have all these definitive micromanagers in place. And so, you know, you just see the currents that flow through the whole when you watch this planet. It's like, oh, look at the clever way it came up with to get from point A to point B. So it's a fascinating world in that way. Let's see, where were we? Oh, yeah, right here. Okay.
Amenemope functioned to conserve the ethics of evolution and the morals of revelation, and in his writings passed them on both to the Hebrews and to the Greeks. He was not the greatest of the religious teachers of this age, but he was the most influential in that he colored the subsequent thought of two vital links in the growth of Occidental civilization. The Hebrews, among whom evolved the acme of Occidental religious faith, and the Greeks, who developed pure philosophic thought to its greatest European heights.
So he's the common father. He's just a very, very significant predicate. And the cool thing is just to know that definitively and to know how far back that was, too, so that you can feel that your roots are deeper than you think. I mean, that's another thing that Western civilization needs to rediscover. The depth of its roots so that it knows its stability more. You know, you have so many people that, think that civilization started in 1960 now, right? I mean, they have no clue of anything before that. I mean, you know, literally, you know, I'm not exaggerating. You know, all these people graduated from college who think the United States, you know, was founded, you know, in the 20th century. Yeah. So, we've lost all of that stabilizing sense of our deep roots, and that because those roots are so deep, what feeds forward from those distant times is not to be flippantly discarded. It's very significant. It's very fundamentally foundational. Like I was saying, if you don't have the Book of Proverbs, you can forget about Western civilization. And I mean, like they're pointing out, that's the predicate. Right? You don't have Judeo-Christian civilization without that predicate. You don't have those basic wisdom nuggets that are there. It's just, you're not going to have, Congress is not going to work. Nothing's going to work. It's just not going to work. Notice here, we talked about a lot of times, you don't need the fifth epical revelation. Matter of fact, you don't even need the fourth, you don't have the third yet. Okay, do you even have what's prior to the third? See? The third is just adding that religious element, right? But do you have the philosophic predicate for the third? There's an emergency because it's extremely uncommon now, right, mm-hmm. that anyone has that.
This Book of Wisdom that they keep. Mm-hmm. Gone, perished, unidentified.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, again, I mean, you know, so much of it is, you know, is there in the Book of Proverbs. You know, you don't really have to worry about going back. You know, do you have the full wisdom of Ptahotep? You don't have to worry about those kind of technical details, right? I mean, start with Proverbs. That's a plenty adequate starting point.
So the only reason is because, people are just, if it's familiar, they kind of blow it off.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, the Book of Wisdom. right? They're willing to consider.
Yeah, maybe it'll help if the Midwayers at some point, in the distant future, restore some of these things, in their original form for us, so we can see what they were originally, were like.
What comes first, the chicken or the egg? You just mentioned religion having to have a philosophic foundation.
Mm-hmm. Context.
And yeah. I've been thinking, philosophy has to have a religious foundation. I mean, that's like one, as well as a scientific foundation, to have a true philosophy.
Well, the reason that you have that chicken egg thing about the relationship between religion and philosophy is whether or not you're talking about the lower hemisphere of philosophy or the upper hemisphere of philosophy. The upper hemisphere of philosophy needs the religious nucleus first, right? The lower hemisphere of philosophy is the predicate for a religious nucleus. See, so it's both are true. It depends on whether or not you're, you know, talking about bottom up or top down. And see, and I was talking about the bottom up. That basic human philosophy that they're telling the Egyptians had, that the Melchizedek missionaries could step into and try to put a religious nucleus into, you know, and make them more definitively spiritual. That's that bottom up. Right. And then the fifth epical revelation, you know, it's giving you the metaphysics, the upper hemisphere, so that you know that religious nucleus, can be taken to a full clarification. But you need the fourth to give you the fifth, right? You need that religious predicate. Okay. Keep going here.
In the book of Hebrew Proverbs, chapters 15, 17, 20, and chapter 22, verse 17, to chapter 24, verse 22, are taken almost verbatim from Amenemope's Book of Wisdom. The first psalm of the Hebrew Book of Psalms was written by Amenemope and is the heart of the teachings of Akhenaten.
See, there's that first psalm, like I told you. Like they were saying back there, you know, that at the end of section two, that's the one that speaks so directly in terms of that Egyptian judgment assessment that, you know, we're kind of talking about between the lines here with Maat and all that. Okay. So it's a perfect transition for them here again, that first psalm.
Did you bring the first psalm?
I didn't, you know. But yeah, that's your homework for everyone. Everyone go home and read the first psalm. It's short.
It's in this building.
But
golden list of references right there in that paragraph.
Yeah, you know, giving you really, you know, clarifying which ones are very, very close. Not so processed. And then, as they're saying, that transitioned us right to Akhenaten. So not only is Amenemope and the culture that he produced the context, the predicate for the Melchizedek missionaries, but then after that, it's also the predicate for Akhenaten. I mean, it's like I was just saying a second ago, Amenemope giving you that lower hemisphere of philosophy, it allows Akhenaten to attempt to definitively put a religious cap on that. Okay, so they work together, and you know, chronologically to do that. So let's we won't be able to read all. This is a long section on Akhenaten, but let's see if we can get into it a little bit here.
Section 5. The remarkable Akhenaten. The teachings of Amenemope were slowly losing their hold on the Egyptian mind when, through the influence of an Egyptian Salamite physician, a woman of the royal family espoused the Melchizedek teachings. This woman prevailed upon her son, Akhenaten, Pharaoh of Egypt, to accept these doctrines of one God.
Okay, see, so we don't know how far back Amenemope was, but yeah, it obviously is back far enough we could be in the tale here, the waning tale. Yeah.
They had women doctors back then.
Yeah. Well, no, it does. That's not what it says. It's
an Egyptian physician, a woman.
No. Those are separate. Oh. The physician is of the woman.
Yeah. Is the woman's doctor?
Yes. Yes. Akhenaten's mom's doctor. who was, part of the Salemite missionary phenomenon, that physician. Yeah. All right, so it just gets right into the Egyptian court. Salem missionaries are on the inside, and Akhenaten is just exactly the person to take to this with a passion. Just resonates with him, very definitively. Those core Melchizedek teachings. Right, right, yeah. Yeah, remember, Menemope's before, Melchizedek, Akhenaten's after.
But they can't be that much before because he was a student, is right?
Or no, not student. It's just, no.
He just learned from his teaching?
Right. You just have the whole cultural context coming down from Menemope's.
Yeah. He was the bottom-up prep.
He was a student, not just a live student.
We're not talking immediate student here.
I gotcha.
Okay.
Since the disappearance of Melchizedek in the flesh, no human being up to that time had possessed such an amazingly clear concept of the revealed religion of Salem as Akhenaten. In some respects, this young Egyptian king is one of the most remarkable persons in human history. During this time of increasing spiritual depression in Mesopotamia, he kept alive the doctrine of El Elyon, the one God, in Egypt, thus maintaining the philosophic monotheistic channel which was vital to the religious background of the then future bestowal of Michael. And it was in recognition of this exploit, among other reasons, that the child Jesus was taken to Egypt, where some of the spiritual successors of Akhenaten saw him and to some extent understood certain phases of his divine mission to Urantia.
So, just, it's not just the 6th century BC quickening that made sure that there was a context for Michael when he came. Akhenaten had a lot to do with it as well. Coincidentally, there was this guy in Egypt. that's very striking that they, point out that the predicate was very dependent upon that that conduit mechanism, through Akhenaten.
So who was it? It says, and it was in recognition of this exploit that these, Joseph and Mary didn't know that, right? Do you know what I'm saying? It was just the way things turned out.
Remember, there was all that relationship with relatives in Egypt,
right?
So, that's why Mary and Joseph went there, right? They did. Not only were they escaping from Herod, but they were going to a place that they knew was already in the modality of what Gabriel had told them about this child, right? See, that's what they're trying to get at is,
Well, Hebrews were strong in that area, right, at that time, in religion.
Well, you see, they're trying to point out yes and no. A lot of the Hebrews are still in kind of a, volcano God, the almighty mode, and so they're trying to point out that there's a philosophic context that the Egyptians have that the Hebrews don't, and that kind of bigger picture context allowed those successors, as they're saying, to Akhenaten there in Egypt all those centuries later to appreciate that someone like Jesus was possible, that wasn't just a bunch of mumbo jumbo, right? It's like we were saying. If you know that God is the predicate, and we're all children of God, if you have that basic spiritual recognition, the message that someone's going to come down from that God, that's completely fits in. It's logical. That's the basically what they're getting at there, you know, that, and to some extent understood certain phases of his divine mission to Urantia. It's just fundamentally because Jesus' mission is a top-down mission as a descending son. I mean, and they're in that mode, you know, that the big picture is coming down to earth. And that phenomenon is made flesh. It makes sense to them. Whereas if you're thinking in a very bottom up, bubbling up fashion, you know, there's predicate for something coming down like Jesus. Yeah, you know, that just isn't anything that makes sense.
How old was Jesus when they left Egypt?
I don't remember. I'd have to go back and look. I can't remember off the top of my head.
He went there almost when he was three, right? So two or three. So he was five, I think. But it's interesting.
But yeah. You know, anyway, they're just pointing out. Yeah, it's not surprising that when they talked about a Amenemope, or even before that, we saw things that sounded were starting to remind us of Jesus. See, they're just saying, yeah, and that's you saw that connection literally play out when they went to Egypt. Right, that connection, manifested in literal travel, right? So,
a couple of times, a couple of groups tried to get him to move back there.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and they're kind of going to get to that sort of thing when you know they say a little bit more here. So let's read a little more.
Moses, the greatest character between Melchizedek and Jesus, was the joint gift to the world of the Hebrew race and the Egyptian royal family. And had Akhenaten possessed the versatility and ability of Moses, had he manifested a political genius to match his surprising religious leadership, then would Egypt have become the great monotheistic nation of that age. And if this had happened, it is barely possible that Jesus might have lived the greater portion of his mortal life in Egypt.
Told you they were just about to get to that, right? You know, just, I mean, again, I mean, Akhenaten was very significant. He could have been even more significant. I mean, the whole New Testament story could have played out in Egypt, right? If Akhenaten hadn't been immediately rejected the moment he died.
The parting of the sea, you know.
Just would have been, very interesting to think about how different the story would have been.
It's because he wasn't political. Is
that what
they're basically saying?
Yeah, right. He was, see, again, like I was saying, Akhenaten is the poster child for you know, being too purely religious in his efforts. Right? And it just, as long as, you know, he's there as Pharaoh, okay, it endures. But the second he's not there, poof, you know, just goes right back to the... but as they're going to point out... because he was not just Joe Blow, he was Pharaoh. The priesthood couldn't totally eradicate the what he put in about the idea of one God.
Could have had Pharaohism instead of Jerusalem.
Never in all history did any king so methodically proceed to swing a whole nation from polytheism to monotheism, as did this extraordinary Akhenaten. With the most amazing determination, this young ruler broke with the past, changed his name, abandoned his capital, built an entirely new city, and created a new art and literature for a whole people. But he went too fast. He built too much, more than could stand when he had gone. Again, he failed to provide for the material stability and prosperity of his people, all of which reacted unfavorably against his religious teachings when the subsequent floods of adversity and oppression swept over the Egyptians.
Why? Because Amenemope taught that riches and fortune were the gift of God. So, right, if there's poverty and misfortune... There's some issue.
Can't be the gift of God.
There must be some issue with God, right? Your relationship to God. Right. It's not just that. As they're saying there, you need a material stability and prosperity. You can't just do some pure spiritual idealism thing. There has to be material pragmatism together. It has to be a cosmic consciousness phenomenon if it's going to endure, right?
In contrast, Moses took his people to a desert. What kind of prosperity were they enjoying? There was nothing but
privation. But he forced material stability, you know. And if it got too unstable, he killed enough people until they get sobered them and they stabilized. Right? I mean, you know, he had to establish some definitive stability. That's so important, you know. And he had the political chops to do it. That Akhenaten didn't. All right.
Had this man of amazingly clear vision and extraordinary singleness of purpose had the political sagacity of Moses, he would have changed the whole history of the evolution of religion and the revelation of truth in the Occidental world. During his lifetime, he was able to curb the activities of the priests, whom he generally discredited, but they maintained their cults in secret and sprang into action as soon as the young king passed from power. And they were not slow to connect all of Egypt's subsequent troubles with the establishment of monotheism during his reign.
This is a problem that we have today too. There was more than just, what they're saying there, a quote-unquote priesthood. There's a whole bureaucracy associated with that priesthood that Akhenaten was challenging in a wholesale fashion. And the established bureaucracy with its high priests doesn't like that. They didn't like it back then, and they don't like it now. This is very problematic when you have, an establishment like that, they may be kind of forced, like they were here to let Akhenaten play out, in the foreground, but they're holding on to everything in the background. And as soon as he's off the stage, they just put that background back into the foreground. Right, they have this whole network that's keeping it all going behind the scenes, and right, they know that Akhenaten's come and go, but they're forever. Right, the establishment, the bureaucracy is forever.
But that's a repeated, way things happen throughout history. They tend to move up and then they go back to where they were, and then they move up a little bit and go back to where they were.
But occasionally, there's someone that has, enough breadth of ability and sort of massive of momentum to break the culture loose from that establishment, right? And have an enduring, improved system going forward. But it's not very often. Because, like they're pointing out here, you're not just taking on him, you have to take on the entire thing. Like they're pointing out, see, if he had had those additional abilities, how did they say that? He would have changed the whole history. Right? Like I say, it has to, Yeah, if you're going to change the whole history, you have to have this very holistic and very solid ability. I mean, you have to, because every element has to, you know, mooring has to be broken, yeah. Right? Not just some. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's going to be pulled back.
Right. Yeah. Like cleansing.
You've got to be able to endure attacks from every direction by every element of the establishment. All right. Let's see, anything else there? The fact that, you know, amazingly clear vision, you know, they're kind of pointing out that, like, whoa, that was an exceptional person. We didn't totally see that one coming. Sometimes, you know, even the revelators, you know, the celestials' ability to predict, you know, who's going to be born when and where and whatnot. I mean, they're occasionally surprised, right? Not everything is predictable. Things can coalesce out of the whole, and those aren't totally predictable. That's why you have to, you know, have experimental worlds, for instance, like ours, you know, to kind of get a little experiential sense about where the whole is, right? Because it has a mystery and an unpredictability inherent in it. So that's kind of cool that, you know, they say amazingly there. All right.
Very wisely, Akhenaten sought to establish monotheism under the guise of the sun god. This decision to approach the worship of the universal father by absorbing all gods into the worship of the sun was due to the counsel of the Salemite physician. Akhenaten took the generalized doctrines of the then existent Aten faith regarding the fatherhood and motherhood of deity and created a religion which recognized an intimate, worshipful relation between man and God.
Okay, not only an intimate, worshipful relation between man and God, but look at just what kind of a great predicate you've got there in this Egyptian culture. The fatherhood and motherhood of deity.
Yeah.
Right? And so, see, there's the fatherhood of deity part, which is what religion is directly going to play off of. And then the motherhood of deity is inherent in their whole philosophic context that they have. See? That's, you know, again, why does the fifth epical revelation have to be the first epical revelation of God the Mother? Because they're trying to give you that upper hemisphere of the sphere of philosophy, right? And that's not tied to the Father. It's tied to the Mother. Yeah. They're going to, you know, when you get that upper hemisphere tied to the Mother, that allows you to improve the religious nucleus, like I was saying a while back, right? From a fourth to a fifth epical revelation of God the Father. Because now you can not just talk about... See, when you have just the lower hemisphere of philosophy and then putting that religious nucleus on top of that, you're just getting the ideal of the Father. But when you give it that upper hemisphere, that metaphysics, now you can start to talk about the idea of the Father. Right? That's what's, you know, we're talking about here. That's what's playing out. And they have the beginnings of that in place there in Egypt. Right? They don't have the revelation of the Mother that gives you the upper hemisphere, but they have the experiential recognition of the basic context of the lower hemisphere relationship to the Mother. Okay. So, you know, I mean, the Greeks were the same way. The Greeks were recognizing motherhood of deity concepts. Because they were getting the philosophy. in the book when they talk about the Greeks. You know, they bring that up. So that's an important thing to reflect on. I mean, why hasn't religion really had the mother? It's like, because that's a philosophic fact, not a merely religious fact. Father's the religious fact. Yeah. But the father without the mother is a part without a whole. Right? It's a concept without a context. So it's not going to go very far. And it's prone to error. Okay. Let's see. And then just look at how this this Melchizedek missionary, this Salemite, as they're calling him, because it's kind of like not really on a missionary mission, but it's a, you know, it's a person that's just there, you know, predicated on the Salemite teachings, helping Akhenaten with some of the practical issues. It's like, no, don't go full on abstract with something like the Universal Father. I mean, the common people can't relate to that. You need to use the Aten, sun disk concept, right? You know, something they can see, right? You know, you can't expect them to go on their insight. Right? They need to predicate their thoughts on sight. So, you know, very practical assistance that Akhenaten is getting. Because like they were saying, he has a tendency to not appreciate, you know, all of those practical details.
Yeah, he left them behind.
So. Yeah, yeah. He's a little bit too heavenly-minded, so he's no earthly good. See?
Big problem for the high-minded help that we get. Big problem.
And so you go, oh, so one of the reasons that he ended up being so influential, it's not just himself, but the help of this Salemite, getting it actually down and grounded enough that it did go on. That Salemite assistant helped him bring it to the people out of the abstractions of his mind, okay, and his internal recognition. So that's an interesting little tidbit, too. Let's just read one more paragraph here.
Akhenaten was wise enough to maintain the outward worship of Aten, the sun god, while he led his associates in the disguised worship of the one god, creator of Aten and supreme father of all. This young teacher king was a prolific writer, being author of the exposition entitled The One God, a book of 31 chapters, which the priests, when returned to power, utterly destroyed. Akhenaten also wrote 137 hymns, 12 of which are now preserved in the Old Testament Book of Psalms, credited to Hebrew authorship.
Okay. So we'll get a little bit more of the details next time. But, so it's not just Amenemope, but Akhenaten also has all... You know, has a lot to do with, you know, the oldest elements of the Old Testament. Notice the contrast. Amenemope into Proverbs and Akhenaten into Psalms. Right? You know, which is the more philosophic, which is the more religious. See how they're working together to give that predicate. And, there's another fun one, you know, the Midwares.
Which one's so?
Have got a copy of the One God book. Yeah. With all 31 chapters. That, you know, what a cool thing to be, have us have restored to us at some point, you know.
And maybe they use it as some of the thought that
of course, you know, they not only have all their records of all this, but they've got the human records too. You know, they're working with all of that to give us what they give us. You notice how, like when we were talking about the chronology, how the revelators weren't allowed to say things too precise. You know, they can just give us a few hints and stuff, but they're definitely encouraging you to go through what you've dug up and dig some more, and you know, use some of these suggestions to put it together in a better way, And you can't help but notice that when all is said and done, they're reminding you that you need to appreciate how your civilization has deeper roots than you think. It's important for you to not be so flippant like you are now about what's come to you from the past.
Key word being appreciate there.
You know, what you need to conserve that. You know, notice that Akhenaten is getting in the mode that a lot of people today do. A lot of readers of the Urantia Book do. Their favorite master seraphim are the progress angels, not the religious guardians. Right? Their favorite seraphim are the ones that need checkmates, like Akhenaten needed, right? How did they say that? He, went too fast or something? Yeah, but he went too fast. He built too much.
Chris, the Urantia Book's not going very fast.
Right.
It's really not too fast.
No, not in the world, but in people's minds.
Oh, yeah.
Well, right?
We'd like it to go fast.
Everybody's at Havona now, and even if it's going to fuse any minute.
Blurb. We're all first circlers.
Right. See, and the irony of that is, if you bias to the progress angels over the religious guardians, you're spiritual but not religious.
Yeah,
okay. See, and it's
maybe
not
they work together.
You need them both, but you can't be. Right, you need them in a balance, right? Or in the name of being, an agent of religious uplift, you're not, right? You know, you're just going to foster magical fiat progress that's going to collapse on you, just like it did with Akhenaten. It's very important that you identify soundly with the efforts of those religious guardians, those that are trying to conserve what's coming forward from very deep roots, right? Because without that, there's nothing to uphold what you progressively lay on top, right? It'll just fall away. So all kinds of great lessons here for us individually thinking about things and what civilization needs. And we'll work through the rest of this next time. And notice they're going to give us a little tidbits about Iran and Arabia too. Before we leave this kind of Near East context. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.